When the rules of society are broken, things can get a little wild. This is Wild Society.
This episode is brought to you by 2-Ply Edible Underwear, for when you're hungry, but also when a challenge. What? I'm Chad.
What? I'm Courtney, and I'm always wondering what's happening.
Courtney looks distressed. I'm Jordan.
I'm Bethany. Welcome back to Wild Society.
We never know what's going to come out of Chad's mouth.
Have you ever had edible underwear?
I have, actually.
Oh.
Yeah,
it's good.
I believe it was Janie. Somebody got them for me for my 21st birthday. And after I got home drunk from the bars, I opened them and I ate them.
Well, was it like a fruit by the foot?
No, they were
fruit
like
by a foot.
You know, like those candy necklaces, those little sweet tart things.
That's someone got me a pair of those for my bachelorette.
In high school, my friend's mom got me a pair as like a Christmas gag gift.
I'm sorry.
It tasted like fruit roll up. But I had it in my car for a long time. Then one day at a red light, I was like, I'm going to eat these.
Ew.
It tasted good, actually. It wasn't bad. Oh, my God. This headphone is still broken from last week.
Chad's headphone is still taped together.
Still taped together.
Barely taped together.
With some scotch tape.
I got, well, not me personally, but our podcast got the biggest compliment from a coworker, James Adams. I'm going to give him a shout out. It's kind of a odd compliment, but it was a good compliment. He said that our podcast, along with like Tiger King and some of those,
yeah,
were, quote, a little glitter in my dog turd of a year.
Oh,
that's what he said about COVID and everything.
That's a great review.
He sounds like a great guy.
Yeah.
I like that.
A little glitter. And I said, that's going to be our new tagline.
Yep.
A little glitter in your dog turd.
We got to redo the intro.
Yes.
Just sparkle in your eye.
So thank you, James.
Your brown,
we're going to put that on a shirt.
That's funny.
A little glitter in your dog turd.
I love that because I understood what he was saying.
So you all know that we have been promoting this local cotton candy company called Yummy. Carnival Sugar. And they just came out with three new flavors, two of which Chad and I have tried.
They're all good.
Sorry, girls. We ate them before you
could. We ate them. All of them.
I'm mad.
Of course.
Humble Pie is one, and it's blueberry.
Ooh, oh, it was so good.
I love blueberry.
Oh my gosh, it's so good. It literally, I don't know how they do it. It tastes just like a blueberry pie.
And I didn't feel humble eating it.
Oh.
The other one is Peach Princess. No, not Pillow Princess, Courtney.
Hey, yo.
Peach Princess. And it's, if you love peach, which I do, peach soda is like my favorite flavored soda. Their other one is like, they have
Manganada.
Manganada. And they also have Carnival Cola.
Strawberry lemonade.
Wait,
ooh. What?
Refreshing.
And orange pineapple.
Okay, see, I haven't even seen these.
Getting some combos going on.
Yum, yum, yum.
Y'all, the point is, their stuff is so good. It really is.
Check it out, carnivalsugar.com.
Oh my God, look at my headphones.
Headphones are so janky. It's hilarious.
You're going to have to hold it. You're going to sit like this.
Like a DJ.
Oh, man. Okay, children, calm down. Before we get into our stories this week, head over to our website, Wild Society
Podcast. Are we still doing stories? I thought we were just hanging out and talking.
Just a banter episode. Head over to our website, wildsocietypodcast.com, to see pictures from today's episode. And with that, Court, take it away.
It's my turn. It's been so long since I've done a story.
Do you remember when you used to write your stories out?
Yes.
Oh my God.
It would take me a long time. A long, long time. I'm excited to do this one. I did not know about this story, but my friend Caitlin just randomly texted me one day and was like, hey, have you heard of Nanny Doss? And I was like, nope, but I will look into it. So thank you to Caitlin for recommending this story. She's a huge supporter of our show. She lives in Atlanta, but she's moving to Dallas. Yay, closer to me.
Nice.
Anyways, I'm going to tell you guys about Nanny Doss, the giggling granny.
That just sounds creepy.
That sounds horrifying.
Gross. Yuck.
Are they going to be like, she's the good one in the episode?
She just likes to laugh.
She's really into comedy, guys. Leave her alone.
She's terrible. Scary. On November 4th, 1905, which is the day before my birthday.
You were born in 1905.
I was not born shit. You're that old.
That's a low-hanging fruit joke.
It was.
Nancy Hazel was born in Blue Mountain, Alabama, to Louisa, or Lou, and James Hazel. Nanny, the nickname given to her, was one of five children, three brothers and one sister.
What a nickname. You instantly sound like an old person, Nanny, as a child.
Jeez. Thanks, you just aged me 60 years.
Back then, Nanny was like a hot, sexy name. Though.
Nanny. Was it?
Yeah, check was out it? Nanny's tits, man.
Oh, my God. Oh.
That fits with this story.
Oh, my God. I don't even
She's
know.
She's 18.
Let's just say there's a lot of men that thought Nanny's tits were nice, okay?
Oh.
Nanny's father, James, was very controlling and did not allow the children to go to school full time. Instead, they spent the majority of their time at home working on the farm and doing chores. Her father was also very awful to her mother, who despised him, but she stayed married to him despite the way he treated her and the children. James controlled every aspect of his family, what they wore, who they spoke to, and where they went. He did not allow his two daughters to wear nice clothing or makeup, and they had little to no interaction with boys outside of their brothers.
And this is where lesbians were born.
We're born.
Nanny began to fantasize about life outside of the farm. She soon came across some of her mom's romance magazines.
Ooh.
Romance magazines.
It's like pre-Playgirl. Hey,
pre-porn.
And down south.
Yeah, and romance books. And she fell in love with reading them.
Look at his ankle. It's so hot and steamy.
This is the early 1900s. So, yeah, you're right. She dreamed of finding love and leaving the farm and the thumb of her controlling father. At the age of 16, Nanny was allowed to get a job, which is kind of surprising, but I guess back then 16 was kind of like, all right, bye. You know, you're an adult. See ya.
My grandma married my grandpa at 16, which is wild.
So did Nanny. Well, not your grandpa, but.
I sure as hell hope not.
She started work at a local linen factory where she quickly met a man named Charlie Braggs. The two married in 1921, just 4 months into dating, with the approval of her father, of course. It is debatable whether Nanny actually loved him or just wanted to get out from under control of her father. But what she didn't know is that she would be moving from a controlling parent to a controlling mother-in-law.
Ooh. Hmm. Which is worse? I don't know.
I don't know. Bragg's mother was very attached to him. He was her only son, and she was a single parent. After Nanny and Bragg's married, his mother continued to live with them. Nanny later wrote, quote, I married, as my father wished, in 1921 to a boy I only knowed about 4 or 5 months who had no family, only a mother who was unwed and who had taken over my life completely when we were married.
Dang.
She never seen anything wrong with what she done, but she would take spells, which I don't really know what that means, but I wonder if that means...
Spells?
Would take spells. She would not let my own mother stay all night. Bragg's mother demanded the majority of his attention and was extremely, extremely clingy, pushing Nanny to the side. She also instructed Nanny's life and limited what she was allowed to do. Although the marriage was strained, Bragg's and Nanny had 4 daughters between 1923 and 1927.
Whoa, they were busy.
Mm-hmm. The stress of the children pushed Nanny to begin drinking, and what was once a casual smoke turned into a heavy smoking addiction. The marriage continued to decline, and both partners accused one another of infidelity. In 1927, their 2 middle daughters, aged 1.5 and 2.5, mysteriously became ill and passed away. Their passing was said to be caused by food poisoning, but it was also reported that their bodies turned black right after their deaths.
Oh my gosh.
Which is sketchy.
Yeah.
Nanny had taken out $500 life insurance policies on both of the girls and collected that money.
Oh, gosh.
After their deaths, Braggs took their oldest daughter, Melvina, and left Nanny with their newborn, Florine. The following year, he returned and was in a new relationship. Braggs and Nanny divorced, and Nanny took both Melvina and Florine with her to live with her mother, Lou.
I'm sorry, Velveeta and fluoride? what story are you telling?
Velveeta. I'm going to say that. Melvina and Florine.
That is unfortunate.
Nanny resorted back to reading her romance novels and fantasizing about love. She also began reading the Lonely Hearts column in the local newspaper, which was like you could write a column about yourself and like kind of like the Craigslist.
Yeah, pre-Craigslist.
Man-seeking woman or whatever.
Pre-dating app.
Yes. She came across the column of a man named Robert Franklin Frank Harrelson. Frank was 23, living in Jacksonville, Florida, and worked in a factory. The two began writing love letters to each other, and Nanny enjoyed sending racy photos.
Ooh la la.
Here's my pinky. I recently shaved it.
Oh, God. Oh, stop.
Did you look at your pinky when I said that?
Do you have hair?
I have hardly any hair.
Do you shave your pinkies?
No, but I saw you look.
I was like, do I even have hair on my pinky?
The pair met and married quickly, and Nanny moved in with him with her two daughters. After a few months of marriage, Nanny discovered that Frank was an alcoholic and had a criminal record for assault. When he drank, he became violent, but Nanny put up with it. Although their marriage was in turmoil over Frank's drinking, Frank and Nanny stayed married for 16 years.
Oh, wow.
Nanny's oldest daughter, Melvina, eventually married and gave birth to two children.
Shells and cheese.
Oh, that sounds so good.
Mm. Shells and cheese. You're just ready for that.
Oh, my gosh. Robert Lee Haynes was born in 1943, and a daughter was born in 1945, but died shortly after birth. Melvina was drugged up from giving birth, and she was groggy, but she remembers her mom being in the room with her. She also recalls her mom sticking a hairpin into the baby's head.
Oh, what? My gosh. Oh, no.
It was not long after that that she was told that her baby girl was dead.
Oh my God.
Melvina asked her husband and sister Florine what had happened. They recalled that Nanny broke the news to them that the baby was dead and that she did have a hairpin in her hand at the time.
What?
Although the family saw all this happen, nothing was ever...
It was like too unbelievable to even fathom, probably.
Yes. And the doctors were unable to explain why the baby died, so nothing was done. They just were like, this baby didn't make it.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Is that the real hairpin, or did you just Google hairpin and put that in there?
That was...
You can get this at Tiffany's?
Yeah.
That's not the actual hairpin, but that was from...
We know what a hairpin looks like.
I didn't.
Oh my God, really?
I really didn't.
I thought this was like evidence when I first saw it. Even I know what a hairpin looks like.
I did not Google it. It was in one of my articles.
I thought it was evidence.
Do you realize I'm 29? I'm not like 65 like you are.
Well, I've not ever used a hairpin. Have you ever seen like a 1920s movie or something?
No. Been a while.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Screw y'all.
Oh, so good. Oh, I thought that was evidence. I was like, is there blood on that? I don't see the blood.
Melvina and her husband were eventually torn apart by grief. Melvina started dating a soldier that Nanny did not like. This caused the two of them to fight and Melvina to leave the house to get some space from her mother. So since her and her husband were separated, divorced or whatever, she had moved back in with Nanny. On July 7th, 1945, shortly after his baby sister's death, Robert Haynes, Melvina's son, was pronounced dead while in Nanny's care.
Oh, gosh.
His death was said to be asphyxia from unknown causes.
What?
But come on.
Yeah. What?
Even more sketchy was that Nanny had taken out a $500 life insurance policy on Robert.
Oh my gosh.
And collected the money 2 months after his death.
How could you murder your grandkids and your own kids?
Because she's crazy.
She is crazy. So now she's at the scene of both of her grandchildren's deaths, but she's never been investigated, interrogated. No one ever questioned it. On September 2nd, 1945.
Oh, my birthday.
Japan surrendered and ended World War II.
The end. Like, what?
That seems random. But Frank, Nanny's husband, was among a large group of American men that were out celebrating. He got drunk, came home, and raped Nanny, which is not okay. Nanny, obviously furious, found his hidden whiskey jar and added rat poisoning to it.
Ooh. If you were going to say what alcohol from last week, I was going to die.
Frank Harrelson died on September 16th, 1945, just 13 days after continuously ingesting poison-laced whiskey.
Wow.
Again, Nanny cashed in on her loved one's death and was given the $2,000 of life insurance money. Nanny then left Florida and headed north. In true Nanny fashion, she was quick to move on, forever on the hunt for fantasy love. Searching through the Lonely Hearts column in Lexington, North Carolina, she came across a man named Arlie Lanning.
Don't do it, Arlie.
The two met and married after just 3 days of knowing each other.
Oh, wow.
Now, I can bet that if you marry someone that quickly, there's going to be issues.
And there can be issues. I don't think.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah. As the two began to really get to know one another, Nanny realized he was just like her second husband, an alcoholic. Not only that, he was...
But she's a murderer, so that's fine.
True.
Oh, he's an alcoholic. Now, sure, yeah. I murdered 15 people, right. But whatever.
So not only was he an alcoholic, but he was also unfaithful. Nanny did not like his behavior, so she would leave the home for months on end. But whenever she was home, she acted like nothing was wrong and pretended to be an amazing housewife. Hmm. Nanny became a member at the local Methodist church and gained sympathy from friends and neighbors since her husband was known for gallivanting with the town sex workers. On February 16th, 1952, just 14 days after his 52nd birthday, Arlie passed away. Doctors believed that Arlie died of heart failure, but again, Nanny was doing some sketchy stuff. Nanny had laced Arlie's coffee and prune snack with poison, which ultimately led to his death. Good prune snack.
Give me that prune snack, baby.
Can I tell you something? Josh, I think prunes are so good.
They are good.
They are really good. They get a little sticky.
Many of their neighbors and friends came to Arlie's funeral to support Nanny, not knowing that she had killed him. Homegirl's on a roll. This is number four and her second husband that she's killed. So I guess she's just kind of figured out if she doesn't get caught, it's easy to an easy way to do it. It's with the poison since now she's done that twice. Nanny was furious to find out that Arlie had left the house that they lived in to his sister, basically leaving Nanny with nothing. But the home burned down not all long after his death.
Oh.
And it was Nanny that was able to collect the insurance money from the fire.
Oh, wow.
Hmm.
Loophole.
You think she did it?
Yeah.
Well, that's just smart.
She's not dumb.
After Arlie's death, Nanny moved in with his mother, her mother-in-law, to take care of her. And she suddenly passed away, quote, in her sleep, shortly after Nanny arrived.
Mm.
The mother-in-law's death was not linked back to Nanny at the time, but I can guess that she had something to do with it. Kind of weird that she moved in with her mother-in-law after killing her husband anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Like, why? What? Nanny then moved in with her sister, Debbie, who was bedridden at the time, to help take care of her. And wouldn't you know, Debbie unexpectedly passed away shortly after Nanny arrived.
Jeez.
So at this point, I'm kind of wondering how no one in her family, none of her friends, started to question, like, why so many people around her are dying. That's a lot of family members that have died.
For sure.
It's in the cheese.
On the hunt for another husband, Nanny joined a dating service called the Diamond Circle Club.
Ooh. Diamond.
Which seems like it's a little risque.
Why?
Diamond Circle Club. She met a man named Richard Morton from Jamestown, North Carolina, and the two married in Emporia, Kansas in 1952. Unlike her previous husbands, Richard was not a drinker, but he did love women and was unfaithful. Shortly after their nuptials, Nanny was informed that her mother was coming to live with them. She had fallen and broken her hip and needed Nanny to help care for her. Bad mistake.
Yeah.
Shortly after arriving from Alabama, Lou Hazel died in the care of Nanny on January 3rd, 1953, at the age of 73. So the count is now at 7 deaths.
This woman's a serial killer.
Yep. May 19th, 1953, 4 months after her mother's death, Nanny served her husband Richard a cup of coffee laced with poison. Reports say that his last words were, quote, "I shouldn't have drank."
Oh, no.
Quote, "I shouldn't have drank that second cup of coffee." Richard was Nanny's 8th victim.
Jeez.
After Richard's death, Nanny did what she did best, looked for a new husband. Who was going to be lucky number 5? Nanny moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hey-o.
And married Samuel Doss in June of 1953, a month after Richard's death. Exactly. Samuel Doss was a widowed Nazarene minister. He lost his wife and children to a tornado in Arkansas. He was different from Nanny's previous husbands in that he was not an alcoholic. But what he did do to piss her off was disapprove of her love for romance novels.
Ooh. God.
Don't mess with my stories.
Mm-hmm. Samuel wanted Nanny to only read and watch things that were educational, which of course was not what she wanted.
You better watch that OETA.
She wanted the spicy stuff, okay?
OETA after dark. OETA plus.
Plus, plus. Plus.
According to AlabamaHeritage.com, Nanny actually tried to leave Samuel and move back to Alabama. Samuel begged Nanny to come back, promising that he would lighten up and let her read and watch more things.
I'll let you look at porn if you'll just come back.
This is the worst argument I've ever heard of.
I can't.
He also agreed to take out 2 life insurance policies on himself.
Oh, no.
With Nanny as the beneficiary.
Isn't there a database?
Dumb.
I can't buy Allegra D without logging in my name somewhere, but she can get married 57 times.
Right, yeah. Right.
Please come back. I'll take out 2 life insurance policies on myself if you come back.
And you can read the Reader's Digest too, I promise.
Just don't kill me now.
His promises enticed Nanny enough that she decided to come back, but her return came with a price for Samuel. In September of 1953, Nanny made Samuel one of his favorites, a prune cake. There it is again.
It was a shit.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, God. This time, when she made his favorite cake, she added a new ingredient, arsenic.
Ooh.
After eating the cake, Samuel became ill and went to the hospital. He was diagnosed with a severe digestive tract infection, but was given medication that was successful in making him feel better.
Oh.
He was able to leave the hospital after a few weeks of treatment. When Samuel and Nanny returned home, Nanny made him a nice hot cup of coffee with arsenic for creamer. Samuel died a few hours after drinking the coffee.
Oh, jeez.
Jeez.
So now she's getting a little sloppy because he just got home.
Yeah.
He just got home from the hospital and you're going to kill him. And you don't think that someone's going to be like, weird. The doctor who treated Samuel at the hospital immediately became suspicious of his death and called for an autopsy. Finally, someone. The autopsy revealed a large amount of arsenic in Samuel's stomach, which led to the quick arrest of Nanny Doss. According to the Tulsa World, Samuel had enough arsenic in him to kill a horse.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So she she was like, I'm going to make sure he did. Detectives had a hard time beginning an interrogation and getting a confession out of Nanny because she was distracted by a Romantic Heats magazine. Which is kind of weird that she even had one of those in the interrogation room. But she did.
What if the police officers had it? She was like, well, here's the thing. Is that one of those magazines over there?
Pass me my stories.
They were surprised by how she acted towards them once they took the magazine and got her attention. She was not the typical murderer and did not have the demeanor of someone who had just killed. Instead, she was giggling and flirting with the detectives.
Oh, jeez.
Ooh.
A skill that she knew all too well since she had been married 5 times. Nanny was interrogated for hours and finally confessed to killing husband Samuel. She told the detectives that her reasoning was because he, quote, got on my nerves. She also complained about how he wouldn't let her enjoy the books, magazines, and TV shows that she liked. A police stenographer who took down Nanny's confession said, quote, "She was as calm and composed as she might have been if she were being baptized." After admitting to murdering Samuel Doss, Nanny exchanged a promise with the detectives that if they gave her back the romance magazine, she would talk about her other husbands.
Oh my gosh.
She loves her stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is, you know, the moral of this story is let your daughters be sluts. Don't keep them at home. Let them dress like a little whore, the town tramp.
Oh my God.
You know.
Express yourself.
They're going to
express yourself.
Express yourself.
They're going to hold in all that sexual energy, and then it's going to explode.
And then they're going to kill their husband. Yeah. I mean,
you're going to kill 17 exactly. husbands.
Nanny told police, quote, "I was searching for the perfect mate, the real romance in life."
God.
It was then that she also admitted to the murders of her other three husbands, Robert Frank Harrelson, Arlie Lanning, and Richard Martin. Not only did she confess to killing all of her husbands except Charlie Braggs, who made it out alive, she also confessed to the murder of her mother, her sister, her grandson, and her mother-in-law. She denied killing or having any involvement in the deaths of her two granddaughters. While in jail awaiting trial for the murder of Samuel, eight of her victims' bodies were exhumed. Autopsies were performed and found that arsenic and rat poison were found in all three other husbands and her mother. The other victims showed signs of being smothered to death. Investigators on the case believed that Nanny killed for convenience and money, obviously. Her family members even said that it seemed as though she enjoyed planning the funerals of her victims.
Ew, weird.
When police were going through her stuff, they found 27 pictures of Nanny at all the funerals that were taken by photographers she had hired to be there.
So
Oh my God. What? Yeah, hired a professional photographer to come to the funeral.
Ew, and she just had them with her?
Yes.
She's a psycho.
God. We should try to get those and put them up around the walls.
Nanny attributed her murderous habits to the fact that she had a head injury when she was young. At the age of 7, she was on a train taking a trip with her family when the train suddenly stopped. Nanny hit her head on the metal bar on the seat in front of her, and it resulted in a big head injury. For years, Nanny said that she suffered from depression, blackouts, and bad headaches because of this head injury. After being evaluated by psychiatrists, Nanny was declared sane to stand trial. In May of 1955, Nanny Doss pled guilty to killing her husband, Samuel Doss. On June 2nd, 1955, she was sentenced to life in prison. The death penalty was not an option at the time because she was a woman. After 2 years in jail, and this was Oklahoma at the time.
Yeah, that's, I didn't know it was gender-based like that.
Oh, women have it so easy. You don't even get murdered in prison.
You don't even get murdered.
But after 2 years in jail, Nanny expressed that she would have preferred the death penalty. Hmm. But good old Nanny continued to keep her creepy, giggly, happy demeanor even in prison.
Oh, that's right. I forgot she's like Mrs. Creepy or something. What's her name?
Nanny Giggling the Granny. Granny.
Mrs. Creepy.
Mrs. Creepy.
That too.
She was said to be a model prisoner and even told a world reporter who visited her, quote, "When they get shorthanded in the kitchen here, I always offer to help out, but they never let me."
Can't imagine why. Gosh. Where's your rat poison in that?
It's so cringy. Like, I can't. And I can only imagine her saying it as like a joke, you know?
And she's sitting there like,
she's like,
like giggling. Ew. You're like,
ew. They won't let me.
Ew. You do that really well. They won't let me.
Although Nanny lived out the rest of her life in prison, she was never charged or tried for any of her other murders. Nanny Doss died of leukemia on June 2nd, 1965, exactly 10 years after she was sentenced.
Oh, wow. Hmm.
She died in the hospital ward of the Oklahoma State Penitentiary. How do you say that?
Penitentiary.
Penitentiary.
Yep. There it was right there.
Penetrated.
Penitentiary? How do you say it?
Penitentiary.
Penitentiary.
Penetrations.
That's a hard
Concentrations.
Word.
That's a hard word to say.
Penitentiary.
Penitentiary.
I was wearing headphones. Headphones are falling off.
He's just got one side of his headphones just flapping in the wind.
Yep. Penitentiary.
Penitentiary. Okay.
Penitentiary.
MoveOn.org.
Okay.
MoveOn.org.
.net.
She died in the hospital ward of the Oklahoma State Penitentiary and was buried.
Just keep going.
Did I say it right?
I think it's close enough.
Okay.
In Beelzebub, Oklahoma.
That's a hard word. And was buried in Oak Hill Memorial Park in McAlester, Oklahoma. According to the Tulsa World, the Doss case resulted in the Oklahoma legislature passing a law requiring an examination by a medical examiner of all individuals who die without being attended by a physician. And that's the story of the Giggling Granny. Mm. She's also known as the Jolly Black Widow and the Lonely Hearts Killer.
Ooh.
So that case ended up being kind of a landmark
just
case.
A fucking bitch.
Yeah, too.
Wow.
Yeah, it
being like a landmark case.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It was just hard for me to fathom a grandmother killing their grandkids.
Children. She wanted that money.
I can't with that hairpin in the baby head.
That's terrifying.
That's terrifying.
Melvina and Florine are her two daughters that lived.
I'm sure her granddaughters are out here somewhere.
Yeah. I wonder if they're in Oklahoma or not. Are you out there?
Please rotel us if you listen to our podcast.
That's awesome.
I have the wild story this week.
Thank God, because I'm so over here in your sketchy murder stories.
Well, you'll like this one.
Oh.
My wild story is actually a survival story.
Well, now you ruined the ending.
And he survives.
But it is definitely a wild story in every sense of the word.
Ooh, I like those. I liked that show, I Survived.
That is a good show.
Yeah.
This might be one of the most intense survival stories I've ever read.
Am I going to get anxiety?
Does someone get eaten?
No.
Good.
This story is about Allison Botha. Allison Botha was born September 22nd, 1967 in Port Elizabeth, South Africa. Her parents divorced when she was 10 years old, and she spent most of her childhood with her mother and her older brother. According to sources, Allison lived a pretty normal life. She attended the Collegiate High School for Girls, where she served as head girl.
Was she like the baddest bitch? Is that what that means?
Is that what that means?
I think it just means like, I guess. Well, I'm referencing Harry Potter, because when Harry Potter arrived at Hogwarts, he met the head boy, and he was like kind of the leader.
Class president.
Student like council
class,
president.
Kind of like that.
Or
yeah,
class,
I guess.
Whatever.
After finishing her education, she spent time traveling before she returned home, taking a job as an insurance broker. We're going to fast forward to December 18th, 1994, a night that Allison Botha was attacked. 27-year-old Allison Botha, at this time, was just pulling into her apartment complex after a night out with her friends. She'd spent the day at the beach, then everyone came back to her place for game night and pizza. After most of them left, she drove one remaining friend home, and then she returned to her apartment. Right as she parked her car, I had read that she felt a gust of warm air hit her, and it's because the driver's side door was flung open, and she was ambushed by a man with a knife who said, "Move over or I'll kill you." Jeez. He then forced himself into the car with Allison. He then forced her to move to the passenger seat so he could be behind the wheel. After referring to himself as Clinton, he then drove to pick up an accomplice. Allison recalls him saying, quote, "I don't want to hurt you. I just want to use your car for an hour." The two men were later identified as Franz Detwee and Theon Kruger. The two men then drove her to a deserted area of the city on the outskirts of Port Elizabeth. Allison recalls how they both told her they were going to have sex with her and if she would try and fight them if they tried doing so. Being terrified for her life, Allison said no. Both men, who had a history of violence towards women against them, raped Allison. Afterwards, they decided to kill her.
Jeez.
At first, both men tried unsuccessfully to suffocate her.
Oh my gosh.
However, even though Allison did lose consciousness, she did not stop breathing. Frustrated, both men then took turns stabbing Allison 30 times in the abdomen.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, I know this.
Allison recalls that she was conscious during that Fran specifically seemed to want to mutilate her reproductive organs. Mm. However, somehow every stab wound missed any of those specific parts.
Wow.
As the men turned to leave, Allison's leg twitched. This led the attackers to slit Allison's throat.
Oh my gosh.
16 times.
Whoa. What? Oh my.
This is a quote from Allison. All I could see was an arm moving above my face, left and right and left and right.
Oh my gosh.
His movements were making a sound, a wet sound.
Oh.
It was the sound of my flesh being slashed open. He was cutting my throat with a knife again and again and again. It felt unreal, but it wasn't. I felt no pain, but it was not a dream. This was happening. The man was slashing my throat.
Oh my God.
She also recalls that afterwards, the men stepped back and she heard them say, "Do you think she's dead?" While the other one replied, "No one could survive that." They were wrong.
Wow.
She was leg don't twitch.
Don't move. Don't move.
Oh my God.
After the attackers left, she remembers thinking, quote, "I had to at least leave a clue about who did this to me."
Mm.
She then wrote the name of her attackers in dirt with "I love mom" written below that.
Oh my God.
After all of that, Allison's body was not going to give up on her. She could see headlights streaking through the bushes and quickly realized she might have a chance to survive if she could make it to the road. She didn't quite realize, however, the extent to her injuries until she tried making her way towards the headlights.
Oh, gosh.
As she pulled herself up, her head started falling backwards.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, no.
Caused by the deep lacerations, which almost decapitated her.
Whoa.
At the same time, she could feel a slimy sensation coming from her abdomen. Her intestines had started spilling out.
Oh, God.
Jordan, all your stories are like that.
She literally had to hold her intestines with one hand to keep them from falling out of her and hold her head up with the other hand.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
And go to the road.
How is this possible? Like, how is she alive?
Allison recalled, quote, "As I struggled forward, my sight faded in and out and I fell many times, but managed to get up again until I finally reached the road."
She's a badass woman.
When she did reach the road, she collapsed right along the white line in the middle.
Oh, wow.
Because she knew, even in a disoriented state, that this was the best place to be seen by a vehicle here, right in the road. Shortly after, a veterinary student named Tian Ellard, who was visiting Port Elizabeth on vacation with friends, saw Allison lying in the middle of the road and stopped his car. He recalled, "God put me on that road for a reason." He used his training as a veterinarian to tuck Allison's thyroid, which was exposed, back into her body.
Oh my God.
He then called emergency services. After being rushed to the hospital, doctors were shocked by her wounds. Alexander Angelov, one of the doctors operating on Allison, said, quote, "He had never seen such severe injuries in his 16 years of practicing medicine." Even though Allison was literally on the fucking brink of death, she managed to pull through the injuries and operations. She also remembered everything about her attackers.
Wow.
Which led to her identifying them to police while she was in the hospital.
Oh, wow.
They were both quickly found and arrested. In the press, they were called the Ripper Rapists. The trial known as the Norhoek Ripper Trial was huge in South Africa. Both men pled guilty to 8 charges, including kidnapping, rape, and attempted murder. Both were found guilty and sentenced to life in prison in August 1995. Afterwards, Allison suffered from PTSD.
Oh.
She wouldn't. From the attack, and rightfully, could you imagine the nightmares?
Oh, no. My God.
Oh, my God.
No, no.
Just like...
Even like the daydream. Bad day.
I mean, well, just remembering what actually happened is a nightmare.
I mean, my God, not even being... getting the luxury of at least of blacking out.
Yeah, man.
To try and recover from the physical and emotional trauma, she realized she needed to face what happened to her, and so she began traveling around the world telling her story in at least 35 countries.
Wow.
She was one of the first women in South Africa to speak publicly about rape and helped inspire other survivors to come forwards and tell their stories.
Wow, that's awesome.
Allison said, quote, "The attack has put me on this path where I get to travel the world and help inspire other people." In 1995, Allison won the Rotarian Paul Harris Award for Courage Beyond the Norm.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah. And Femina Magazine's Women of Courage Award. She was also honored as Port Elizabeth Citizen of the Year. Since her attack, Allison has written two books, and in 2016, her story was made into a film called Allison.
Oh, interesting.
She is still currently considered one of the most inspiring motivational speakers in the world. In an interview with Good Housekeeping, she said, quote, "Life can sometimes make us feel like the victim. Problems and hardships and traumas are dished out to all of us, and sometimes they can be divided very unfairly. Remind yourself that you do not have to take responsibility for what others do. Life is not a collection of what happens to you, but of how you've responded to what has happened to you."
That's good.
And that is the story, the crazy survival story of Allison Botha.
Wow.
Oh my God.
Man.
She's amazing.
Yeah, for real. She is our patron saint of badass women now.
16. Your throat being slashed 16 times. Nope. And it missing everything in your neck.
Yeah. She was meant to live.
I had also read that because they had suffocated her, they crushed something.
Oh, interesting.
In her neck or like pushed it back or something. Wow. And that
helped her out.
Helped her.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's crazy.
She's probably also swollen. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So a little bit of that probably helped too.
That's crazy to think that.
Yeah.
Them.
Like the order of everything. It, yeah.
Then later saved her. Whew. Y'all women.
Y'all women.
It's scared. Like, I'm so scared for you.
Yeah.
Like all the like stuff you have to deal with, just kind of like always.
Yeah. There's that saying that's like, men are afraid that women will laugh at them and women are afraid that men will kill them.
Oh my God.
It's just like, it's two totally different ways of living life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so proud of Allison. Go Allison.
Yes. She's amazing.
And then they wrote a song about her.
Allison. Thanks for listening this week. Head over to our website, wildsocietypodcast.com, to see pictures from today's episode. We love you guys, and we will see you next week.
Get some shells and cheese.
Oh, I was going to say prunes and Velveeta.